Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu. Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how one group hopes to use the arts as a way to reach out to teenagers on issues related to mental illness.
First, when President Obama won the 2008 election, his ability to mobilize young Americans was credited as playing a big role in putting him in office.
In the years since, millennial enthusiasm for the president has quieted down some, and today headlines characterize young Americans as largely uninterested in national politics.
That's not been the case for the student campaign behind Ron Paul's 2008 bid for the Republican presidential nomination. The group called Students for Ron Paul transformed into Young Americans for Liberty, and it's been growing on college campuses since 2008.
The youth libertarian group, which promotes a smaller role for government, has had a particular success here in Wisconsin and across the Midwest. This Saturday, Wisconsin holds its first state convention for Young Americans for Liberty.
UW-Baraboo student Eric Shimpa is the Wisconsin State Chair of Young Americans for Liberty, and Haley Sinclair is the Director of Communications for the UW-Madison chapter. Central Time producer Galen Druk sat down with Haley and Eric to learn what's motivating the growth.
How did you two get involved in Young Americans for Liberty? We'll go with Eric first.
I got involved with Young Americans for Liberty after I talked to a couple of my friends from up north, and they got me in contact with Todd Welsh, who's actually the state coordinator for Campaign for Liberty, and he told me how I can get involved as a student. And, well, I started my own chapter at UW-Baraboo, which only had 500 students, and then I grew it to, 15, 20 people strong. So after that, it kind of took off from there, so...
And you?
I got involved with it. I had originally been exposed to libertarian-type ideals just through my own research and information and a little bit from Ron Paul's campaign in 2008 and 2012. So just building off of that, I actually came across Young Americans for Liberty at a student org thing. I think either in the fall or the spring, they do it twice a year. Came across them. They had kind of a neat little political quiz to see where you fit on the political spectrum, and found that I aligned pretty well with them, was interested in what they had to do, that they were really an activist group doing things. And though I hadn't gotten involved right away my freshman year when I first found them because I was too busy, even though I just couldn't balance my schedule, eventually sophomore year I womaned up and got involved, and I'm really happy that I did.
You mentioned Ron Paul's 2008 campaign, and that's actually what Young Americans for Liberty was born out of, if I understand correctly. What was it, Students for Ron Paul?
Yeah, it was Students for Ron Paul as well. The founder of Young Americans for Liberty led the youth campaign for that 2008 campaign. So he was pretty well involved in that and wanted to take those ideas and those types of principles and bring it to an activism effort that could be used across campuses.
And Eric, what's the growth been like since 2008?
It's been explosive. When we first started nationally, we only had about 25 chapters. In Wisconsin, we only had one, which was at UW-Madison. It's the original. But now, today, we have, 25 active chapters across the state and over 600 nationwide. That's only been over the course of 5 years, so that's pretty explosive.
So I was actually looking at some of the numbers for different states in the U.S. for how many YAL, that's Young Americans for Liberty, chapters there are, and Wisconsin has a lot, and the Midwest in general has a lot compared to the other states. Is there something about Wisconsin politics, Midwestern politics, that is kind of attractive to young libertarians?
I'm not sure. I mean, I would say that a lot of people in the Midwest, especially Wisconsin, is more of a swing state, at least in presidential elections and some other cases. So I think that swing has people, especially young people, caught in the middle, deciding whether they want to go left or right or if they identify more as independent. And so that independency that a lot of millennials are identifying as now has played a role in the Midwest and just some of the political climate here, especially in Wisconsin, and helped gear people into finding their nook, whether it be in the liberty movement or elsewhere.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously, within within party politics. It all starts in Iowa with the straw poll, and I think that there's a lot of volunteers that came from not only Wisconsin but the Midwest all over the place to go help Ron Paul out in both 2008 and 2012 for both of those presidential campaigns in the straw poll, and I think that that pulls on a lot of culture too. There's a lot of people I know that are involved with chapters that have helped out with his campaigns and stuff in the past, so yeah.
I think oftentimes the stereotype is that on college campuses, a lot of the students lean towards being liberal. You know, I mean, how have you guys been received on your campuses by your fellow students?
I think a lot depends on the issues that we're tabling on. So, for example, we just did a tabling event in February on the legalization of marijuana. That's going to be well received by our general population of young people in general, regardless of what party you identify with or ideology you identify with. But when we do other tabling events that maybe people would consider more controversial, like we did an informative event on Obamacare last fall, those things are going to create a little bit more friction, especially at UW-Madison. However, our goal is not to create that friction, but to have that information out there so it's not always a one-sided campus where you only provided that one-sided information, that that other dissident, maybe minority voice isn't squashed, and at least the message is out there. We're not there to, you know, prick any thorns in the sides of people. We're there to give the information to our fellow peers because we think that's what's most important.
Right. And a lot of the things we do on campuses, too, is that we'll do I like to call it nonpartisan issues, but really they're just non-controversial issues. Issues like the national debt. Like you'll do a big event where you'll have a giant national debt clock to visualize the actual debt clock. And, you know, nobody's going to be like, oh, we need more debt. Like nobody's going to do that. So it's like it's kind of a way to get the conversation started kind of thing. So, it gets people into that mindset. And I think that that really is responsive on college campuses.
So before we get into more sort of specific ideas of the libertarian movement, I want to ask you a broader question. When Ron Paul endorsed your group, he said the importance of YAL to the future of liberty cannot be overstated. Now, your title is Young Americans for Liberty. That's a really big word with a lot of meaning, liberty. Maybe keeping away from specific issues or buzzwords of the moment, what does liberty mean to you guys?
Liberty to me is essentially being able to do things on your own without intervention. Essentially, get the government or get the government out of your hair and let you kind of do. You know, people know how to spend their tax money in some instances a lot better than what the government could, and I think that liberty to me is essentially. That is where you can actually do things on your own better than the government can, plus you get the freedom to do it.
From what I understand about the libertarian movement, when it comes to economic policy, libertarians tend to side more with conservatives, Republicans. When it comes to social policy, libertarians tend to side more with liberals, Democrats. So a lot of times there aren't libertarians, though, on the ballot. So what do you do?
Essentially, what we're doing right now, at least as a broader nationwide movement or even statewide movement, is reforming the GOP, really, is what we're doing. Because the way that the political process works now with two parties, you're always going to have some type of resolution, no matter what the issue may be, or just a general policy that will meet far enough into the middle to reach that 51% that it's almost impossible to really truly have a third party libertarian party have that effect and really win office or sway elections very much besides the few percentage points you sometimes see. So what we're doing is really getting back to the basics, restoring principles, and our big focus is if you want to run as a Republican on conservative principles, you need to stick to your original notion of small government, and that includes social issues. You can't advocate for small government and then advocate for government to enforce your morals. So it's really like, honestly, we're just kind of coming in, invading, and saying, you know, if you want to advocate for this, you have to be true to your word. And that's what we're doing right now because it would be almost too difficult to work from that third party aspect.
Right. You said that part of YL is sort of reforming the GOP. So does that mean that you guys ultimately lean right?
The organization as a whole, there, even though there are other student groups out there, Young Americans for Liberty, I think, in my opinion, from what I've seen, is that it is more of a right-leaning organization. And I say leaning very, you know, briefly. It's not that hard leaning. But what I mean by that is that more often members of YAL are more focused on fiscal and economic issues than they are generally on social issues. But that's not to say that they don't generally, you know, support those social issues as well. It's just they end up focusing in on that. And I agree with what Haley said, is that it's a third party. Even though third parties are great, they're just not viable candidates at this point, and you kind of have to work within a party to be able to actually make political change.
Now, one of your group's campaigns is called War on Youth. So do millennials feel like young people are being attacked, or maybe if not explicitly attacked, at least ignored?
I don't know if I would say attacked or ignored. I'd say we would be definitely disadvantaged in a poor system. Just given the amount of debt that we're facing now, whether it be college debt or just national debt, the amount that we're facing as future taxpayers and current taxpayers is really detrimental to our future well-being. And we see that, and we see the impacts that that can have for us and other varieties of just very misused and abused budgets that are affecting a greater number of people than those that were involved. And so we see how it can affect us and how, you know, we're fed up with that. We're not going to put up with a system that continues to perpetuate that, not be held accountable. You know, we're calling attention to it because we refuse to put up with a terrible system that's just further going to hurt us more than the generations before us, honestly.
A good example of what she's saying is on, like, the issue of Obamacare. And we've done a couple events on it before where it basically, the point she made is that it's a disadvantage for the youth. And the reason why I say that is because more often than not, with Obamacare and the mandates that it's being proposed with it, is that the youth are the ones who are going to really have to pay for it, because they're not going to really get a lot of benefit out of it until they're later down the line. Whereas right now, the more elderly people, they never had to pay into it before, yet they get all the benefit for it. So it kind of shows that it's a one-sided policy there.
So how much ultimately does Young Americans for Liberty get you involved in the political process?
I would say it doesn't necessarily advocate for getting involved in politics, especially once you get more involved in it. Sometimes it gives people kind of a sour taste of it, you know, the reality of politics. But I think the more you get involved in activism and really making a difference, it's just a self-motivation that once you've seen your own actions or your group's actions or whatever you can call attention to, see any type of an effect, then it gets you motivated to maybe be involved beyond that, no matter what your major may be. I mean, I'm in social sciences, so I probably intend at least pursuing politics a few years after graduation and then maybe pursuing something else, whether it be law or what have you.
Could you see yourself running for office?
At this point, I wouldn't say no. I would like to – the only thing I'm weary about of office is sticking more locally to offices. I don't know if I would want to get wrapped up in the bigger, broader Washington, D.C. side of things, just because I know how – or have some idea of how dirty it can be. I won't rule it out. But I would rather, at this point, I enjoy being an activist and really spreading a message a lot more than maybe, you know, spreading promises of what I would do.
Now, Saturday, April 26th is your first Wisconsin state convention. What are you hoping to get out of it?
Well, the whole idea here is that we want to get as many people there as possible. The point here is that we've worked very, very hard over, you know, the last 5 years of us setting up chapters across the state and getting all these activists involved with the groups that they're in, and that's great. But the point here is that we really want to get them together, so that way that they can network together and be able to kind of expand their reach on how active they are within outside of a college setting, because they're only in college for, you know, 4 years and then, you know, then you're done. Then what? Well, the whole point here is then to give them opportunities to expand, to get jobs and whatnot in the actual liberty movement in itself. So,
well, thank you guys so much for joining me this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Central Time producer Galen Juke speaking with students Eric Shimpa, Wisconsin State Chair of Young Americans for Liberty, and Haley Sinclair, Director of Communications for the UW-Madison chapter.
Wisconsin is holding its first Young Americans for Liberty State Convention on Saturday. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As teenagers try to navigate the challenges that arise with coming of age, some struggle more than others.
Sometimes the pressure to do it all, to get good grades, stay involved in sports and extracurricular activities, and get into the best colleges and universities can be too much. Some teens have turned to suicide.
As a result, mental health advocates in the Milwaukee area are banding together to address the issue head-on. Hoping to bypass the stigma of mental illness, one group is turning to the arts as a vehicle for talking openly about it.
Brenda Wesley is the Director of Education and Outreach for National Alliance on Mental Illness of Greater Milwaukee. Brenda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How prevalent is the issue of teen suicide today in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin in general?
Well, the rate of teen suicide is escalating. The reasons why is a lot of pressure, just when you did the opening of the show, a lot of pressure on teens. Our kids are living with depression, anxiety issues, which can be biological effects, but the numbers are increasing. And that's not only with teen suicide, but that's adult suicides as well.
Why do you think that the numbers of suicides are increasing? Why now?
I think because the stresses of life, because a lot of times with mental health disorders is that stresses can actually bring about a mental illness if you have a predisposition to it. And even with depression, sometimes we don't want to say that clinical and major depression and anxiety is a mental health disorder because of the stigma associated with it. So we don't have that conversation to say that maybe the biology of the brain has changed as far as coping mechanisms. We're not talking to kids and even adults about how to cope with things that happen in their life. And then if you're dealing with the other issues as far as depression and anxiety and any other mental health disorder like OCD, probably bipolar disorder and mental health disorders like that, that can just kind of escalate you into the realm of just kind of feeling hopeless and not being able to talk to someone and actually being judged as well. And stigma is one of the number one reasons that people and kids do not seek services.
Well, let's talk about that stigma for a moment. You are, let's say, a young adult. You're in pain. Who do you go to typically when something like that is happening in your life?
You keep it to yourself, because if I reach out to you, stigma in various communities, it looks the same, but in various communities, it can be different. And then if I look to you to tell you that I'm depressed, a lot of times people say, well, why are you depressed? Maybe you live in an affluent family, things are going well, you have no reason to be depressed. Or if things are not going so well, well, just pull yourself up by your bootstrap, you'll be okay. And sometimes you're not okay. All I need for you to do is to listen to me and not judge me for telling you that I am not okay. I need somebody to walk with me to understand. Because usually with depression and suicidal ideation, it kind of goes hand in hand. And to tell someone to stop being depressed is like telling them to walk through a brick wall. Well, it's impossible. We don't tell people to stop having cancer, to go and treat yourself, and the cancer will go away. But when it comes to mental health issues and the idea of suicide and not being able to talk to people, sometimes you feel like you don't have any other place to go.
A lot of times the stereotype, I guess, of teenagers in the media is that they're moody and they're erratic. Their moods swing back and forth, and they could be happy one moment and depressed the next. And that's just the way it is to be a teenager. That's part of the reality of those hormonal mood swings and the developing brain. How much does that play into this, that people just think that, you know, this is how teenagers are?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They think that, okay, they're just going through this spurt of being rebellious. But when you look at it and that's why we have to start having the conversation in our communities about mental health. Because if your child, if it's affecting their ability to live, to love, to go to school, to have social activities, and it's going on for more than 2 weeks, then what is wrong to say, we need to go and talk to someone? Because if your child, and I usually talk about this when I'm out in the community doing presentations, if your child came to you and said that I have a stomach ache or a headache, and probably after a couple of days you ask if you're doing okay, but if it lasts more than a couple of days, a week or 2 weeks, what do we do? we take, or ourselves, we go to the hospital, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to mental health issues, it's, and we know that it's impacting that person, we still don't say, well, let's go and have this checked out, because it's just not normal teenage behavior. Because, of course, and you're absolutely right, teens do, you know, they can act giddy, they can get depressed, and they have a lot of stresses, and sometimes behavior is impacted, and it's just growing up. But when it gets to a point where it really affects the family and what's happening to your child, and if they start to isolate in their room, or if they show a shift in their personality that's quite obvious, then we need to say, we need to go and talk to somebody to find out what's going on.
We're talking right now with Brenda Wesley, Director of Education and Outreach for NAMI of Greater Milwaukee, about teen suicide prevention and reducing the stigma of mental illness.
And we want to hear from you. Have you been affected by teen suicide? As a parent, have you had teens going through depression, anxiety? How did you cope? Did you find help out there? Are you yourself a young person struggling, not sure where to get help? Or do you see this among your peers, among other students? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org.
After the news, we'll talk with a youth minister who, along with others in Milwaukee, banded together to develop a community response to the rising tide of teen suicides. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. First, we continue our conversation about mental illness, teen suicide, and the struggles faced by those grappling with those issues, and we want to hear from you. Have you or a loved one been affected by mental illness? Has the issue of teen suicide touched your life in some way? Is there a way to reduce the stigma that can surround these issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Brenda Wesley of NAMI of Greater Milwaukee stays with us, and now to explain how community groups can come together to address these issues is Margaret Rohde. She's the Young Adult Minister of Holy Family and St. Robert Parishes in the North Shore area of Milwaukee. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, you're a member of a group called Red 2. What is it, and how did it get off the ground?
Yes. Red 2 is a community organization that came together in the North Shore of Milwaukee area after a number of suicides by teens and parents and recent graduates over the course of this last summer. Red, the group, is determined to make a difference by resiliency building, educating the community, and decreasing stigma around mental illness. The amazing thing has been what began as a small group of people coming together hoping to not just grieve and heal and get through these tragic, horrible deaths in our community, but to come together and decide that we as a community were going to work together to help the entire community, all the teens, all the youth, all the adults, try to grow in resilience and strength and to know how to help others who are struggling, how to identify and get them the help that they need.
It's a difficult thing to deal with on lots of different levels. Where do you start? What are some of the actions that Red 2 is taking to reach out?
Right. Well, we started by getting everybody at the table, and it was beautiful. People came forward who had lost their children, who had lost siblings or friends, and came and shared our grief and supported each other, and then said, what do we have at this table that we can bring to the community to help the community grow stronger? And Cheryl Baldwin from UW-Milwaukee in our area, who's with the Youth Work Center at UW-Milwaukee, helped us to identify that we really had four subgroups at the table. We had a number of faith communities from all over, you know, Jewish, Christian, Catholic, different traditions who saw that we have a role in helping people to heal, but also helping people to identify that they have a need and to connect them with resources. We had a group of mental health professionals who were already active in the community, just wanting people to be able to access them. We had a group of concerned parents in the community who were aware that the stigma was
an obstacle that we had to work together to tear down. And we had schools and people, staff and involved families in schools and students at schools who said, it's not just about the academics anymore. What can we do to help teens grow as whole persons, stronger, mentally healthier, but also to identify those who need the extra help? So we divided into those four subgroups and we evaluated the resources that we had, and we started brainstorming ways that we can work together. And it's been so beautiful to see the way the community really has pulled together and begun tapping each other. So, for example, we talked earlier about Brenda's pieces production. The interfaith community felt very strongly, the interfaith subgroup, that our community needed that as a way to open conversation and bring more awareness. So 10 congregations and Young Life, which is a parachurch, awesome organization, came together to sponsor pieces. In addition to that, we've got our parent and community group running book clubs, just looking at books, which it's a lot less pressure to just come to a book club and discuss. Discuss the blessing of a B-minus, the blessings of imperfection.
I'm just going to jump in right now because we've got lots of people waiting to talk to you.
Absolutely.
Folks. And that's important, too. So let's go now to Luke, who's joining us from Cross Plains. Hi, Luke.
Hello. I was just calling today. Normally, I probably wouldn't, you know, call in or talk about this at all, but I felt that it was important that for anybody who is listening right now who deals with depression and suicidal ideations, you know, I've had two friends who have committed suicide, and I have also dealt with that issue myself. And mm-hmm. I know, personally speaking, that when kind of going through the process of trying to get in a better mindset, it's important that the therapist that you're talking to, or, you know, whomever you may be speaking to about it, for that person, it's important that they feel like they're being understood, like their position is understood. Because if it's not, then, you know, it, kind of the mindset is that, you know, well, they have no idea where I'm coming from, so why should I be listening to what they have to say?
So making sure, Luke, that there is a good fit and a good connection going on between the therapist and the person who's struggling.
Yeah, and it's mostly for the people who may be struggling themselves, that, you know, it's kind of like prescription medicine, you know, antidepressants, SSRIs, that one may not fit, you know, your specific biology, but, you know, another might. And it's kind of, you know, you got to kind of jump back into it. If, you know, even you had a bad experience once, it doesn't mean the next person's going to be, you know, not a great fit for you.
All right. Well, Luke, I'm so glad you called, and I'm sorry for the loss that you had to go through. Brenda, what do you think when you hear Luke's story?
Absolutely. I am not a clinician, but being an educator is that to be understood, and I think I talked a little bit about that as far as the stigma, to understand, not sympathize, but empathize with someone is that I will walk with you. I will stand by you. I understand. Again, if you tell someone just to stop being depressed is like asking someone to walk through a brick wall. It's impossible. So to...
And Brenda, are you still with us? I think we may have lost her. And I'll see now if...
I'm here.
Okay. Wait, is this Margaret or Brenda?
This is Margaret.
Margaret, why don't we let you pick up on that? You heard the thread of where Brenda... What do you think about Luke's comment?
Luke, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I so share your frustration. So often I have teens come to me who someone finally helps them get up the courage to go seek professional help, and they don't have a good click with the first therapist that they go to, and then they give up on therapy. And we just strongly encourage everyone to know that, you know, there are two predictors of success in therapy. The first is individual client variables for sure, but the second is that fit, that rapport between you and your therapist. And a very good therapist might not be the best therapist for you. There may be another one out there, and we just encourage you to continue trying until you find someone that you do fit and click with, because therapy can help. And the same way you're trying to find a correct balance of medications, you're trying to find someone who understands you and can work with you and help you take the steps that you need to heal. So we hear you, and we encourage everyone. RED, our organization, puts out a list of all the different
mental health treatment in our area that people have found helpful. And we also say, if the first one doesn't work, try again, because find someone who works for you.
All right. Well, thank you, Luke, for that call. We appreciate that very much. And we'll move now to Morgan in Milwaukee. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you think about this issue?
Well, I'm now in my 40s, and I did, when I was 20, try to kill myself, you know, based on a situation, you know, that I had faced. And so glad that obviously that didn't work for me. But I wanted to point out that as a woman, the depression that I experience now has gotten worse as I've gotten older, and it is so inherently tied to my monthly menstrual cycle that it's perhaps 100 times worse when I have PMS with, you know, my depression than it is any other time of the month. It's like I'm a completely different person. And my medical doctor prescribed birth control to try to level those hormones out so that I didn't experience these extreme lows.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern did fall in with, like, insurance matters, if insurance wasn't going to cover birth control, because it's not just for birth control. It does help, you know, women with mental health matters because of the cycles and the hormones.
Okay, well, thank you much for that call, Morgan. And Brenda, how do hormones and the changing hormones of teenagers in particular contribute to problems of depression and mental illness?
Well, I think it definitely has an impact, but I think it's important that each individual is treated as an individual. When you're seeking services or you're seeking a doctor, that, again, we are not cookie-cutter people. And so it's very important that your doctor does understand that you share that information so that doctor can make an informed decision when they are prescribing medications, and that's with teens as well, because sometimes some of the antipsychotic medications that may be used, you have to be very careful with the dosage. So it's just very important that you seek out a clinician that listens to what you have to say, and again, and to understand who you are and what you're dealing with.
And we've got about a minute left, but I wonder if I could have you both chime in and talk a little bit about the play you're putting on tonight. It's called Pieces in My Own Voice. Let's start with Margaret. What is the play?
Well, the play, Brenda could maybe speak to this better than I, is...
Yes, because I wrote the play.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
yeah.
Though, Margaret.
Let her speak to that.
Yeah, let's go with Brenda then. Brenda, tell us about the play.
As an educator, writing the play is that I needed to figure out how could we get the community to start talking about mental health. And I truly believe that arts is the way that we can open up people's mind, hearts, to understanding just about anything in our society. So the play addresses mental illness and the stigma. So it kind of, you take a peek into the darkness of what stigma looks like, but definitely we talk about the light of recovery and what that looks like. We do address suicide, bipolar disorder, major depression, anxiety, a lot of the issues that individuals deal with, but we use the arts through music and dance and vignettes to address these issues so we can truly open up the dialogue. And after the production, we have a Q&A, which people stay, 98% of the audience stays for the Q&A because now they're ready to talk about their own struggles, the struggles of their family members, and then they're ready to receive the services that we may, that we offer again after the production.
Well, Brenda, and I'm sorry, Margaret, go ahead.
We have a resource fair available so that anyone perhaps who has moved during the course of the production can access some of the resources before they leave the building.
So there'll be a play and an opportunity to move forward for people who might want to keep the conversation going and need some help.
Yes. Yeah.
Excellent. Absolutely. Well, Brenda and Margaret, I'm so glad you could join us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
We've been speaking to Brenda Wesley. She is an education outreach coordinator for the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Greater Milwaukee, and Margaret Rohde. She's the young adult minister of Holy Family and the St. Robert Parishes in Milwaukee.
First, this week marks William Shakespeare's 450th birthday. That got us thinking about Richard III, Iago, and other famous villains from Shakespeare and beyond.
In today's Share Something segment, you're our guest. You can call in and share your favorite fictional villains from books, TV, film, what have you, Shakespearean, and of course otherwise. You can call now and get your vote in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can tell us what makes a memorable or appealing or frightening villain or villainess and why villains can be such engaging characters. Again, 800-642-1234. And Veronica, we picked to kick things off here one of our favorite actors.
Ian McKellen.
Ian McKellen, and in one of the Shakespearean villain roles. We've got him and in the movie version of Richard III, the opening speech here.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths. Our bruised arms hung up for monuments. Our stern alarums changed to merry meetings. Our dreadful marches to delightful measures.
Oh, he seems like such a pleasant fella. He's not going to any kind of politically motivated killing spree, is he?
You kind of want to hang out with him.
Yeah. Until the bad things
happen.
Well, now, how about you? We want you to share your favorite villains or villains you love to hate from books, movies, TV, literature. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we'll go to our first caller. Patrick is with us from Brule. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, how you doing today?
Okay.
Excellent. Hey, well, I was waiting for your last segment, but I'm a huge villain fan of comic books, and I'm always for the underdog and the villain because he always gets defeated. But I love Dr. Doom, but, you know, on a broader spectrum, you know, because it's not just about comic books, is how can we bridge or expose the new generation of kids to the villains of past? In a way that, you know, the kids can, I mean, try to reincorporate the old villains to the modern day times.
Oh, that's interesting. I love it. Well, that's kind of what Richard III was doing, taking Shakespeare and putting it in a different setting. Dr. Doom, enemy of Fantastic Four in the Marvel comic strips, a good one. The reclusive scientist turned into a diabolical supervillain. Thanks a lot for getting us started, Patrick. And, yeah, throwing comics into the conversation, too.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that. And we go next to Dan, who is joining us in Menominee. Hi, Dan.
Well, hi there. So I kind of hate to keep going with the comic book theme, but
go
I'm
for
have
it.
To go with Lex Luthor. Well, thank you. I think that Lex Luthor is actually a villain that you can identify with.
How so?
I know he fights against this symbol of truth, justice, in the American way, but we forget that Superman is an American. He's not even human. He's an alien that is imposing his views on the human race, and Lex Luthor sees this as a problem. He thinks that it makes us weak. He thinks it stifles innovation. So I think Lex is actually fighting for humanity in a very real way.
So you sympathize with Lex. You think he's onto something.
You know, I really do. I really do. And not to spoil it for anybody, but in the newer comic books, Lex is actually a part of the Justice League.
Wow.
Like, he's a good guy now.
I have not seen that. That's a twist. Do you think it's important to be able to identify with them? Because sometimes you've got, like, Sauron from Lord of the Rings or, like, you know, Cthulhu from Lovecraft. They're just implacable, non-understandable evil.
Well, I, you know what? I do like that. And that really is wonderfully convenient. And I love the Cthulhu mythos, too. But there's not... I don't really see such a thing in real life as 100% evil and 100% good, which is where the evil characters that you can identify with really hit home, because you look at somebody, you know, maybe not Lex Luthor, maybe like a lesser villain, and you say, you know, a little a little bad luck and some bad decisions, and I could be a villain of a story.
Right. I'm with you, Dan. I like it when the villains are complex, when they're not just sort of monolithically bad and you'd expect nothing but evil to come from them. But I was, you know, telling Rob that I really like Loki from the films, like many 13-year-old girls. But I find him a really compelling character. And it's fun when the villain is interesting to watch and you see sort of good and evil at war within them, too. And it sounds like that's what you're saying about Lex.
Oh, absolutely. And Loki's a wonderful example. He wasn't necessarily evil in Norse mythology. He was just
a trickster.
That was his nature.
Yep.
All right. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Brought a lot to the table there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your favorite villains of fiction, movies, TV, you name it. We've got Pat on the line in Madison with us now. Pat, hi.
Hi. My favorite villain is Kathy from the John Steinbeck novel, East of Eden. The reason I like her so much is because she just has like the most poetic story kind of from beginning to end. My most like haunting vision of that book is kind of this scene where over the course of like several months, this businessman falls in love with like a young version of Kathy. And basically she completely manipulates him and he goes broke and he's like stressing out all the time about whether or not she loves her. And of course she doesn't love anyone. Kind of one of the things about Kathy is she's incapable of love or almost most emotions. And she just like uses people for her whole life. And then by the end of her life, she is just like totally empty. Kind of, she is like really rich, successful or whatever. But, kind of she owns like a whorehouse and stuff and she just feels completely empty. And at the end, she, just like kills herself with like poison and kind of recites some words from Alice in Wonderland, like really sadly, like the human in her kind of realizing that living her life so evilly, like just made her want to not live. And I thought that was just the ultimate villain.
Did you pity her at the end, Pat?
I think everybody pitied her at the end, yeah.
Sounds like a lot of pathos in that villain. I like that, too. There's the complexity in. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Pat. And Mark on Facebook has said, I don't know about favorite, but I nominate the judge from Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian as the most villainous.
I haven't read Blood Meridian. I can't comment
on that. I haven't either, but I've got a pretty good sense that Cormac McCarthy could write a pretty compelling villain.
And I like the point, I don't know about favorite. These aren't necessarily people we like, but maybe engaging would be a good way to put that.
Right, or love to hate. Mm-hmm. All right, well, speaking of love to hate, let's go to Scott, who's got a villain in mind. And Scott is in Madison. Hi there. You're on the air.
Well, yeah, so my favorite villain currently, I think, is Tywin Lannister from the series and book Game of Thrones, just because he's such a he's such like a tragic hero almost at the same time. Like, he's definitely cast as a villain, however... He's definitely striving for his own family, and his own family almost hates him at the same time. Like, he definitely loved his wife, and he lost her, and he's turned into this hateful person, but he's still, like, a great ruler who works for his people and his house almost exclusively.
It seems like his whole family pretty much does hate him.
Yeah, but he has a backstory and a motivation for what he thinks justifies all the bad stuff he does.
Yeah, I mean, in the series they even talk about his brother views him as like a absolutely righteous person. I mean, he's definitely like, you know, proud and he fights for things, but his brother Sir Kevin talks about how he kept the entire family together. He like saved his house from like destitution. It's a big word, but I think he's definitely an under-respected person for how actually good he is. We're just seeing the story mostly from the perspective of his enemies.
Scott, thanks a lot for the call. More people on the line. I'll just list. We've got nominations for Blue Duck from the novel Lonesome Dove, Lady Catherine from Pride and Prejudice, Vic from the TV show The Shield, Mike in Applin says the Joker from Batman. You could still share yours on the Central Time Facebook page.
Who's your favorite, Rob?
Wow. Well, here, we're playing a song. Darth Vader is a standby. I'm an old Star Wars nerd from way back. Game of Thrones says a lot. When we've heard Loki from you, Veronica.
Yep, amen. I agree with all of yours, too, and I would add Cersei to that pile.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, coming up, writer Barbara Ehrenreich contemplates life with a wild god. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.